Okay, before we get started, I just want to let everybody know, if you don't know, that Dave Baker had to resign because he was appointed to the USDA director for Maryland and Delaware. So potential conflict of interest with us receiving USDA funds and him also serving on the board here. So he did resign. We did appoint Robin Griffith. She just retired 2 weeks ago, and she was unable to make it to the first meeting, but she will be joining us in the future. So now that we have a quorum, we're going to start the meeting. So I'd like to call the February 17th Pension Committee meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is approval of the November 10th, 2021 minutes. Are there any questions or concerns about those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they'll stand approved. And the item on the agenda today is the update on the pension and OPEB performance. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Pat Wing to go over our performance. Good morning, Pat.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Gina, and good morning, everyone. Bear with me for a quick second here as I try to share my screen. Let's see here. Okay, can everybody see my screen there, hopefully?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. So today is, Gina mentioned, pretty light agenda, just covering an update on performance for the funds themselves. And obviously the bulk of the discussion will center on the fourth quarter. However, we also have an update through January, like we normally do. And for those of you who follow financial markets, it's been a very different environment, to put it mildly, so far here in 2022 than what we saw in Q4. So while I work through the market environment, which is where we normally begin, you know, I'm going to plan to weave in some comments around various things that what we believe have been impacting markets here in January, and also provide the committee some color around, you know, our broad thinking around markets moving forward, in addition to, you know, how the funds are positioned at the end of January and why, and some additional changes that we had made in January to the funds. So with that said, let me shift gears here, and I'll bring up the market environment. And as you all know, we start with an overview of the market environment, the economy, markets, to provide context for how and why the funds performed the way they did and how some of the underlying managers performed the way they did. So we'll start with the U.S. economy, as we always do. And you can see in the top right chart here, just at a high level showing U.S. real economic or GDP growth, where the bars are the quarterly numbers, the striped bars towards the end are economists' estimates, and then the orange line is the year-over-year number. But if I can draw your attention to this last fully colored in bar, that was the economic growth data that was posted for Q4. It actually came in pretty strong, just a shade under 7%, which was above expectations of under 6% during the quarter. And the biggest driver of economic growth, in fact, more than 70% of the economic growth came from just private industries restocking their inventories, right? We all know about the global supply chain issues. We see the barren shelves at various stores and things of that nature, but we've begun to see some moderation in those supply chain issues, allowing businesses to restock their inventories. And as we look ahead to the rest of 2022 here, much of the economic growth for the rest of the year, even though it's predicted to slow down a little bit, is predicted to come from the continued restocking of private businesses and their inventories. And there's a big runway for them to do so. If we just look at the retail industry down below here, for an example, what we're showing in the chart is the blue line is the retail inventory to sales ratio. So the gray dotted line is the average over the past 25 years or so, and it's around 1.5. So in other words, retailers usually carry about 50% more in inventory relative to their sales. However, you can see further to the right here, this number fell off a cliff amid the pandemic, and now they're carrying just barely more in inventories relative to their sales. So even though we saw this huge jump in inventory restocking, again, there's a broad runway or broad scope for firms to continue to do this to drive economic growth here moving forward. Now, obviously that is dependent on continued moderation in some of these supply chain issues. But as I mentioned a second ago, we are seeing some alleviation of those pressures. Now, we also know that a lot of the supply chain issues have driven a lot of the inflation that we've seen over the past 12 months. The most recent inflation report that came out about a week ago showed inflation increasing at about 7.5% from a year earlier, which was the highest level since the early 80s. And much of that has been driven on the good side of the economy, right? Things like retailers, you know, gas prices, things of that nature. And it's really been concentrated in that one area of the economy. However, we are seeing it now broaden out into other areas. And as we shift gears here to page 10, I want to talk a little bit about the labor market itself. So the theme going around these days, I'm sure some of you or all of you have heard of it, the Great Resignation, right? There's a lot of people in the private sector workforce and the public sector quitting their jobs, either looking for better opportunities, higher wages, or leaving the workforce altogether. And to illustrate the impact of that, if you look at the top right chart here, what we're showing is this quits rate, again, the percentage of people leaving their jobs here in the darker line, versus the unemployment rate over time. And you can see there's a very, very strong relationship. And I should note that the green line, the unemployment rate, is inverted. So in other words, when it's rising here, it means the unemployment rate's coming down, which is indicative of a tight labor market. And when the labor market's tight, you know, jobs are plentiful, that's when people feel comfortable quitting their jobs because they think that it'll be relatively easy to find a new opportunity. But if you look more recently here, you can see a big divergence where this quits rate is at historically high levels and really consistent with an unemployment rate of almost 1%. So the labor market is incredibly, incredibly tight right now. And that's leading to a lot of wage gains for consumers, which in isolation is a good thing, right? More money in people's pockets, drive consumer spending, drive economic growth. However, it depends on what companies do in response to those rising wages, right? Do they try to pass them along, to consumers, which could further feed inflationary pressures? And we think that this dynamic within the labor market has really caused a huge shift in the Federal Reserve's outlook for policy. So this bottom chart, and we've shown this in the past, shows the orange line, short-term interest rates that the Fed controls, and then the lighter blue line and darker line are projections moving forward. So you can see the market in light blue is projecting maybe 3 or 4 rate hikes this year in line with the Fed. However, this data, even though it's only 7 weeks old, is almost irrelevant. Given recent Fed speeches and given this hotter inflation that's been expected, right now markets are predicting rate hikes maybe instead of 3 or 4 this year, maybe 6 or 7 from the Fed. So these dynamics around inflation and what the Fed is going to do in response to that has caused a lot of the investor angst and the equity market volatility that we've seen so far here in 22. Namely that if inflation continues to be persistent, you know, how is that going to eat into corporate earnings? What's that going to do to equity valuations? And again, if the Fed is going to tighten policy, as I showed earlier here on the previous chart, essentially at a time when the economy is already poised to slow down. So the Fed, in other words, is tightening into somewhat of an economic slowdown. So those myriad of factors have really driven a lot of the equity market weakness and equity market volatility that we've seen so far here in 2022. Now, outside the U.S., there are similar dynamics playing out. In other words, economic growth outside the U.S. also strengthened in the fourth quarter. And in response to that, a lot of other global central banks are tightening policy or raising interest rates. So in this top chart, these are estimates from Morgan Stanley, just the percentage of central banks in blue, developed markets, and then in gray and emerging markets that are raising rates at the end of this year or projected to do so here in Q1. So there's a lot of similar policy dynamics unfolding outside the U.S. that are unfolding inside the U.S. The one key difference, however, as we note in this last bullet point, is actually in China, where their economic growth slowed rather meaningfully in the back half of this year. And we talk a little bit about why that was, but a lot of it driven by their, you know, quote unquote, zero COVID policy, essentially locking down various provinces within within the country whenever COVID cases are popping up. So economic growth has slowed there meaningfully, and policymakers there, instead of tightening, are actually loosening. They're cutting interest rates. They're lowering bank reserve requirements into response to that slowing economic growth. So it's very interesting in that, you know, one of the largest central banks in the world is moving in the other direction than many of the other central banks. And when we think about that in relation to the funds themselves, like we talked about throughout last year, we added a direct emerging markets equities allocation. And as I'll show here in just a second, that's been a little bit of a headwind. But so far this year, it's actually changed course. And we're pretty comfortable with that allocation or that overweight because generally over the past couple of decades, investor capital is usually compensated the best in areas where policy is loosening rather than tightening. And since China comprises such a large portion of the emerging markets universe, we think that's going to be a tailwind for emerging market equities relative to their non-US developed market counterparts. So with that said, we'll talk a little bit about markets here, really focusing on the chart to the right, showing global asset class performance listed here from top to bottom. The green bars are the Q4 numbers, and those darker bars are the 2021 numbers. And from a high level, the relative performance was largely consistent with what we saw in the third quarter. So if we focus specifically on equities, you can see U.S. equities were the best of the bunch, outperforming international developed equities, which then also outperformed emerging market equities. Now, from an absolute return perspective, returns were much better. In Q3, U.S. and international equities were slightly in the red. In Q4, they posted decent gains. And then even though emerging market equities were down about 1%, that was much of an improvement from Q3 when they were down about 8%. Now, the other two things I'll mention quickly on this page, you can see bonds were essentially flat during the quarter. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the interest rate environment because it was very interesting how various rates changed across the Treasury yield curve. But before moving into some of the other asset classes on a more granular basis, I'll mention that real estate, which, as you know, comprises of about 5% of each respective fund, was up about 7.5% during the quarter in Q4. So playing the role in the portfolios that we wanted to, providing diversification, but also at a time when inflation is high, elevated, and increasing at a more rapid rate, doing very well, right? 7.5%, one of the best performing asset classes during the quarter. So with that said, just want to dig a little bit deeper into the U.S. equity markets, and then we'll round out fixed income before jumping into the funds. And it was a really interesting market within U.S. equities. So I showed the gain earlier. It was about 9.3%. As I note in the second bullet point here, much of those gains, or really the bulk of the gains, were driven by growth stocks, and particularly large cap stocks. So those really mega cap tech related names like the Googles, the Apples, the Facebooks, the Amazons drove the bulk of the gains. So when you have the largest stocks in a benchmark doing the best, it's typically a difficult environment for active managers. And this was particularly in the global space, as I'll show in a few minutes. Namely that those global managers can invest in U.S., international, or emerging market equities, but the U.S. equity market comprises about 60% of that global benchmark. And when those largest stocks, again, are driving the bulk of the gains, it's usually a headwind for relative performance because the managers tend to be a little bit more diversified for risk management purposes. So in other words, they won't hold just, you know, a few stocks and have that comprise 20 or 25% of their overall funds, again, to be a little bit more diversified. So when those large stocks outperform, it tends to be a difficult environment and vice versa. The last thing I wanted to mention is that that dynamic was really only in the large cap space. When you go into more small and mid cap companies, it was actually the opposite. Namely that value stocks outperform growth stocks and higher quality stocks did better. And digging into that latter point, you know, amid the pandemic, there was a handful of these profitless sort of technology related names that were supposedly had these secular tailwinds from COVID, right? Staying at home, working from home, e-commerce. So names like Zoom, right? Peloton, DocuSign, names like that, that outperformed dramatically amid the pandemic. But in Q4 really took it on the chin at the prospect of the economy, you know, continuing to reopen and short-term interest rates rising. So why that's important within the funds in that small and mid-cap area, we tend to have a value overweight within small caps. And then within mid-caps, the manager we use there is more of a higher quality type manager. So in other words, they won't hold those lower quality type of names. And since higher quality outperformed low quality, those two tilts within U.S. equities were very helpful for the funds. The last thing I mentioned before we jump into the data itself is in the fixed income markets. And I really want to talk about some of the things that we're monitoring here in this very volatile environment. So the first being the yield curve here. So you can see in the top chart, just the various yields across the maturity for treasury securities here from left to right. The dotted line is where yields stood at the end of September. And then this blue line is where they stood at the end of December. So really interesting here, you can see on the short and intermediate part of the curve, rates jumped rather notably. So this is really an anticipation of the Fed raising short-term interest rates as we head through this year and into 2023. But then as you look on the larger or the longer parts of the curve, really in the 15 to say 30 year range, yields actually fell a little bit. So in other words, the yield curve flattened. And in and of itself, that's not terribly surprising. You know, if you look back over the past 10, 12 Fed rate hiking cycles, the yield curve tends to flatten. So in other words, short-term rates tend to increase more than longer-term rates. However, what we're monitoring very closely is how flat that curve gets. So in other words, if the curve inverts. And if the curve inverts based on history, that's a pretty good harbinger, unfortunately, you know, poor omen that of equity market weakness and perhaps an economic recession. So we're following the shape of the curve very closely as we head through the first quarter and as the Fed starts raising interest rates. The other thing we're monitoring pretty closely is you can see below, namely high yield spreads. So the additional yield that investors demand for holding high yield bonds, which are more speculative, carry more credit risk than treasury bonds. And that spread historically has been a good omen for future equity market performance. So in other words, when spreads are very, very tight or low, investors aren't demanding a huge premium to hold those bonds relative to treasuries, then equity markets tend to do well. But it's important to monitor the change in those spreads because they tend to lead equity markets. So if we think about prior to the pandemic, we saw spreads increase before equity market weakness. If we think back to the financial crisis, high yield spreads blew out well before the market topped. So it's said that kind of credit leads and equities follow. So in the first quarter, we've seen spreads widen a little bit or you know increase, but they still remain quite comfortably below their long-term averages here showing the dotted line. So again, something we're following pretty closely here in order to determine whether or not we should position the funds more defensively, namely again, one, that shape of the yield curve, and then number two, what's going on in credit markets. So that was a lot of information, you know, more detail than we typically provide. So I'd just like to pause here quickly to see if there are any comments or questions around that before we jump into the funds themselves. Okay. So let's continue here and we'll start as we always do with the pension. And again, we have the January update, so we'll give you a more up-to-date picture of where things stand here in just a few minutes. But you can see the market value of the fund at the end of the year was just a shade under $159 million. There was an investment gain in Q4 of $8 million, and the fund returned 5.3% net of fees, slightly ahead of that policy benchmark of 5%. For the year as a whole, there was an investment gain of just under $21 million and a return of 15.1%. which was about a percentage point ahead of the benchmark. So as far as the quarter's concerned, what helped the fund outperformed? In other words, positive attribution explaining the outperformance, it was a couple things. Number one, outperformance by the US equity mid-cap manager that I mentioned a second ago. And then secondly, outperformance by the one active non-US manager. I talked about the value overweight within small caps during the market environment. And the other key driver was outperformance of the fixed income within the fund itself relative to the benchmark. Now, on the negative side, I had mentioned this a couple of times during the market environment, but just to reiterate, we saw some underperformance from the active global equity managers. And then also the emerging markets overweight within non-US equities was a little bit of a drag, because as I showed, they were down about 1.3% versus developed non-US markets that were up 2.7%. So having a little bit more money and emerging markets relative to that benchmark was a little bit of a drag. The other thing I wanted to bring to the committee's attention was that the private infrastructure investment was funded at the end of December. So if you recall, towards the end of 2020, the committee approved and council approved a 5% allocation of private infrastructure, and that was funded at the end of December. In addition to that, in early January, since that funding amount was originally supposed to be about 5% of the portfolios, but since the market values increased so much in 2021, the ultimate allocation when it was funded was closer to, say, 4 to 4.5%. So what we did was add a complementary manager, namely Cohen and Steers here within infrastructure. So this is a mutual fund where the manager's buying and selling the stocks of companies that own and operate infrastructure assets. So in order to get that allocation backed up or closer to the target, we added that as a complementary piece. And then we did make some manager changes in January, and I'll circle back to them and provide a little bit more commentary during the update. Now, from a high level perspective, here on page 20, you can see where we began at the top left here at about $150.7 million during the quarter. Where cash moving in and out of the fund was pretty minimal, and then the investment gain below of about $8 million. So we ended up about $8.1 million higher than where we began during the quarter. I'll circle back to these returns here in just a minute when we look at them from a peer perspective, but did want to note from an asset allocation perspective all the way at the bottom, you look all the way to the right here and see yes in green up and down across the board, just indicative of the fact that all of the current asset classes are within their permissible ranges as per the investment policy statement at the end of the quarter. Now, as far as some of the changes made during the quarter, I mentioned a minute ago how the private infrastructure was funded at the end of the year. If you all recall, that 5% allocation was coming from 2 percentage points of equity, so 1% in US and 1% in non-US, and then 3% in fixed income. So you can see the changes that were made all at the end of the quarter to raise the money for the $7 million commitment to private infrastructure. So all told, there was about $4.35 million out of equities to fund that, and then the remainder out of fixed income. So actually, the timing was rather fortuitous given how markets have behaved so far here in 2022, where equity markets are down in the order of, say, 8 to 10%. Fixed income's down another 3%. Just the timing of the call itself led us to raise assets for that out of equities and out of fixed income right at the end of the year. In other words, right before markets started to take it on the chin. So it was rather fortuitous really to sort of sell high in equities and fixed income to fund infrastructure at the beginning of the year. Now, with that said, I'll dig a little bit deeper into the returns here. As you all know, we use a third-party platform to generate these reports. And given that, it gives us an opportunity to compare how the fund's doing to relative to other public defined benefit funds out there. So a lot going on this page. If you just focus on the bottom two rows here where you see the circle and the X, as we work our way from left to right, you'll see those Q4 returns that I mentioned earlier, and then the rankings in parentheses. So that 5.3% return was good for top 14%. In the universe. Again, if the number was 50 in parentheses, you'd be right in line with the median or the average. If it's below 50, it means you're doing better. So the numbers are a little counterintuitive, lower is better and vice versa. And then similar story for fiscal year and 1 year as well. So in 2021, pretty strong absolute and relative performance and recouping a little bit of the underperformance in 2020, of when we began managing the assets, when admittedly we were a little bit conservative coming out of COVID, right? So we were a little bit more defensive from an asset allocation perspective and a rebalancing perspective that caused a little bit of underperformance in 2020 when we began managing the assets, but more than recouped all that here in 2021. So the last thing I'd like to do before jumping into the OPEB is just spend a couple of quick minutes talking about, again, the drivers of the performance during the quarter. So again, at the top level here, you can see the three-month return that I mentioned. Most of the outperformance was driven by the equity segment. So here you see total equities, which is a weighted average of the U.S., global, and non-U.S. equity managers. So in aggregate, that was about 0.4 percentage points ahead of the benchmark, and all driven within the U.S. equity space. Here you can see that asset class about a percentage point ahead of the benchmark due to the factors I outlined earlier, namely that the mid-cap manager, the one active manager, was comfortably ahead of their benchmark, again, because they focus on higher quality stocks, which were in favor, and also having that dedicated allocation of small cap value stocks, which did much better than growth stocks. And we're really comfortable with that latter allocation because value stocks tend to outperform when rates rise and inflation is persistent. So we think that's going to continue to be a good place to have, you know, a little bit more money than the benchmark here moving forward, as rates are likely to rise and inflation stay elevated as we head through the rest of the year. Now, as far as global equities are concerned, you can see in aggregate, as I mentioned earlier, it was a tougher environment. So even though they made money, they were about a percentage point behind the benchmark. And to sort of illustrate my comments around how it was a difficult environment, if you look at Artisan here, one of the active global managers, they were up 4.8%, about 2 percentage points behind the benchmark. But even though they were 2 percentage points behind, they were in line with the median, right? So if you think about the benchmark itself, the benchmark was probably close to top quartile. In other words, doing better than 75% of all the managers because those larger stocks drove the bulk of the gains. So just trying to illustrate the comment, when those larger stocks drive the bulk of the gains, it being a difficult environment for active managers. And we'll actually see the opposite of that here when we get to January in just a minute. Then as far as the non-US equities concerned, just slightly behind the benchmark at the asset class level, again, largely driven by having a dedicated allocation to emerging markets down here, which you can see was, again, down 1.3% versus the benchmark of 1.6. Below that, you see real estate, Clarion, the manager there, again, up a little north of 7.5%. Again, one of the best performing asset classes in an environment where, which we would expect that, right? Inflation higher and accelerating, so outperforming global equity markets and also fixed income as well that we'll see on the next page. But before getting there, you can see JP Morgan, which was funded at the end of the year. So we don't have any returns for that yet since the money went in at the end of the year. It's just being invested at the beginning. But to echo my comment from earlier, you can see how that allocation was just around 4.5% compared to the target of 5, because this was about 5% when we made the commitment. But since the fund had grown so much in 2021, once the commitment went forward, it was underweight relative to that benchmark. And then finally, in fixed income, some outperformance, as I mentioned earlier, you can see it was down 0.4% versus the benchmark at down 0.6. Wilmington Trust was in line with the benchmark. So what that tells us, just, you know, if we use it based on, say, you know, an accounting identity here, if Wilmington Trust was in line with the benchmark, then the other three pieces or managers that we're using in aggregate drove the outperformance relative to that benchmark. So long story short, for the fund as a whole, a lot of the outperformance came from the equity segment, specifically within the U.S., and then fixed income drove some of the outperformance as well. So with that, let me pause again here for a quick second. We could run through the OPEB rather quickly before we jump into January, but let me pause to see if there are any questions or comments from the committee. Okay. So as I mentioned, for the OPEB, we'll walk through this pretty quickly. As you know, the asset allocation mirrors the pension, and the implementation mirrors the pension as well, because it's our best ideas across the various asset classes. So the market value of the fund at the end of the year, $63.6 million. Investment gain of $3.2 million. You see the returns mirroring the pension there. 2021, $8.4 million gain and a return of 15.3 versus 14.1. So a little bit higher than the pension. If you recall, around this time last year, or maybe a little later, the global equity structure of the pension was a little different than the OPEB. And we made changes in the March-April timeframe. So in the beginning of 2021, the global equity managers for the OPEB did a little bit better than the pension, and that really drove the slightly better 2020 run return for the OPEB than the pension itself. But as far as what drove things for the quarter, the JP Morgan statement, and then the manager changes that I had mentioned in January, everything follows suit per my comments for the pension itself. Now, as far as the summary of cash flows, again, pretty straightforward here. You can see we began at about $60.4 million, basically no cash out, cash flows in and out of the fund itself. So the fund grew by about, call it $3.17 million during the quarter. Again, we'll hit the returns here in just a second, but similar to the pension, you can see all of the respective asset classes in line with their permissible ranges per the policy statement. And then as far as the changes, again, comments that I made a minute ago, largely the same as the pension. So again, funding the $2.75 million commitment to JP Morgan, 1.65 of that was sourced from equities, the remainder from fixed income. And again, the timing of that investment, again, proving rather fortuitous given the market returns, both in equities and fixed income that we've seen so far here in 2022. So then finally, to wrap up the OPEB before we jump into January, you can see again in the bottom two rows from the peer perspective, 5.3% return, good for top 16%. Fiscal year to date, similar story. 1 year, similar story, good for top 16%. So in the last year, again, strong absolute relative performance in both funds, and again, recouping some of the relative underperformance we saw from 2020, which was again owed to being a little bit more conservative amid and coming out of the pandemic. So with all of that said, that wraps up my comments for the performance report. I'd like to cover the January update in just a couple short minutes here. But again, I'll pause for any questions or comments around the fourth quarter performance report itself here before shifting gears. Okay. So if you could bear with me for a quick second here, I will bring up the update. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, and I'm sure, again, you all well know, the market environment for not just equities, but fixed income has been the polar opposite of what we saw in Q4 and really all of 2021. So just before we get into the fund returns itself, just to illustrate that, you can see the U.S. equity broad market benchmark here, the Russell 3000, down about 6% in January. Global equities down about 5.2%, and then international equities down 4%. So again, a lot of the factors I spoke about in the market environment really driving the equity market weakness and volatility here so far in 2022. But with that said, the fund itself did protect on the downside. In other words, you see QTD, that's just January here. The fund was down 3.2%, but ahead of the benchmark at 3.8%. And now for the fiscal year, up 1.8%, about a percentage point ahead of the benchmark. So what drove the outperformance? There were some similar aspects as Q4, but some things that were different, namely that equities drove the bulk of the outperformance. You can see the total equity composite about a percentage point ahead of the benchmark. U.S. equities were only slightly ahead in this case because the active manager that we used was a little bit behind as opposed to being ahead in Q4. But what offset that was, again, small cap value stocks. Even though they were in the red, you could see they were well ahead of the broad market benchmark and, again, well ahead of their small cap growth counterparts. Again, in an environment of rising rates, rising inflation, that area did well on a relative basis. Now, where things were a little bit different was in the global equity space, because those larger stocks that I mentioned earlier that did so well in Q4 actually underperformed in January. So that was a tailwind for January for these managers, as opposed to being a headwind that we saw in Q4. So as I mentioned, they were behind by about a percentage point in Q4. They were ahead by about 2 percentage points in January alone, again, given those larger stocks had underperformed. In the non-US equity space, a similar story, kind of a mirror image or the polar opposite of what we saw in Q4, namely that emerging market stocks were actually ahead in January. I'll speak more to that in just a second, but you can see the asset class down just under 1%, well ahead of the benchmark. So what drove that? Number one, Schroders here, international value manager, even though they were slightly behind, you can see the value benchmark was actually slightly positive compared to the broad market benchmark that was down 4.1%. So having a little bit more in value stocks internationally was helpful, because like the US, value stocks did better than growth stocks amid rising rates and rising inflation. Now you'll see two new names here within non-U.S. equities. And we sent a memo out on this earlier in the week, but just wanted to cover it more quickly. We've added two new managers here, one Harding Loebner, which you can see is an international small cap manager. So much like the U.S., in non-U.S. markets, small caps have tended over longer periods to do better than the broad market. Now, we have some small cap exposure in Schroders. They have some small caps, but they're value stocks. So we've added a complementary piece here, which is a dedicated small cap manager to number one, increase the allocation of small caps within non-U.S. markets for reasons I just mentioned. And number two, they're more of a higher quality growth type manager. So in other words, they're doing something that'll be complementary to Schroders, which focuses on value stocks. And then the other name you'll see here, the new name, Wellington Emerging Market Opportunities. So we swapped out the index fund, the Fidelity Emerging Markets Index Fund, for an active manager here. Historically, active managers, or more active managers than not, have tended to outperform the benchmark. So when we think about using active managers, or much like any decision we'll make, we want to do it where the probabilities are in our favor, right? So if more managers than not outperform over time, then it just increases the likelihood that we'll be able to select one of those managers that are going to do that. So that's a new name in the fund. And I'll mention that in January, emerging market stocks were only down 2% relative to the broad international market that was down 4%. So something that was a headwind again in 2021 has turned into a little bit of a tailwind here in 2022. And again, we're still comfortable with that overweight given the reasons I outlined during the market environment. As far as real estate's concerned, you see zero here. It's not reported on a monthly basis. It's reported on a quarterly basis. Some managers report monthly, and what we've seen from them is positive returns in the neighborhood of 1%. So real estate continuing to provide that diversification downside protection. So in other words, even though we don't have a January return, it would likely have been around 1%. So the number I showed on the previous page for the total fund is probably a little bit understated since we expect a positive January return from real estate. Within the infrastructure, you see it was down slightly, even though, again, we don't have a return from JP Morgan because it's reported on a quarterly basis. What that's saying is that Cohen and Steers, even though they weren't in the fund for the entire month, since they were added, it was down slightly. Now, global listed infrastructure stocks actually outperform broader global equities, as we would expect, again, in this sort of inflationary environment. They were down about 3% compared to global equities, where they were down about 5%. And if we think about things moving forward here, from an asset allocation perspective, you can see the real estate relative to the target, and then infrastructure relative to the target, about a percentage point overweight given the environment. Again, concerns around inflation, and that really being sourced from, when you look at fixed income and cash in aggregate, they're underweight to the respective targets. So we're running, in other words, you know, an underweight to fixed income and cash, and using that to have an overweight to assets, again, that should perform well, at least on a relative basis, if these concerns around interest rates and concerns around rising inflation continue to follow suit here in the near term. And then from a fixed income perspective, just to wrap up, you can see slightly ahead of the benchmark. Wilmington Trust was slightly ahead in January. So again, thinking about it as an accounting identity here, what that means is the rest of the managers here essentially also were in that 1.4% range, again, slightly ahead of the benchmark. And then to wrap up on the OPEB, again, all of those comments I just made about relative performance and changes follow suit here. So I'll just wrap up here on the return itself, again, in line with the pension, since, you know, the asset allocation and the manager changes are largely follow suit. The managers being used are the same. And then for the fiscal year to date, up 1.7 versus 0.9, really just due to rounding of the returns. If you recall, the pension was up 1.8%. But then a similar story here from asset allocation, again, about a percentage point overweight to more inflation-sensitive assets like real estate and infrastructure, largely being sourced from fixed income and cash underweight relative to their targets. So again, that wraps up my comments for today. I appreciate you bearing with me here. I wanted to provide a little bit more detail just given the markets so far this year, you know, what we're thinking about, what we're watching, what we're doing. So I appreciate you bearing with me a little longer than my usual overview. But with that said, that wraps up my comments. But again, happy to answer any questions or comments the committee has at this time.
Pat, you said we were fortuitous in getting, I guess, selling high on equities and fixed income to get into infrastructure. But so what happened, and the numbers aren't in front of us, but what do you think happened when we bought into infrastructure?
Well, it's hard to say at this point because we don't have those returns for that manager. What I can tell you is that in last year, JP Morgan, which is a fairly consistent strategy over time, generated returns of around 2% each quarter. And they were about 2.3% in Q4. And given the environment in Q4 was pretty similar to what we saw in Q1 from an economic perspective, I would expect that, you know, if we sort of forget if it's extrapolate or interpolate, that 2.3% number in January, I would expect JP Morgan to be up probably a little less than 1%. So well ahead of equities and fixed income, but we just don't have that reported yet. The first time we'll have the quarterly numbers when we meet again in May, we'll have that the Q1 number, and I'll be happy to pass it along as soon as we get an estimate in early April.
I'm definitely concerned with inflation, the possible inverted yield curve, you know, all this going on. You said you're going to look at maybe becoming more defensive in our portfolio. Does our investment policy statement give you enough flexibility to react if you have to before us meeting again in May?
Yes, it does. So we really, if you think about, Gina, we have two levers, mainly to pull to that. So number one, you know, straightforward from an asset allocation perspective. So there are ranges of plus or minus 5% around the various asset classes. So that's a good lever that we can pull up and down in order to be able to do that. And then secondly, the allocations within the respective managers themselves, right? So some are more defensive than others. So we can also move money between funds and then become more defensive that way. So long-winded answer to your question, but yes, we have the tools in the toolbox to be able to do that.
And, you know, we're relatively conservative, so
yes.
Are our benchmarks even, is it something we need to look at in the future, saying 63% equities is now too high at this point? I know this is a marathon and not to time the markets, but I do get concerned with what I'm seeing.
Yeah, we do as well. And, you know, I mentioned the inverted yield curve. You know, we're not anywhere close to that yet. Obviously, it's something we're looking, but if we think about history now, the average sort of peak to trough drawdown in a non-recessionary type of bear market's around, say, 14 to 15%. And there's a wide range around that, but we've already drawn down about 10%. So even though we think we could continue to see some more volatility here in the coming months, I think that's just going to be until we get some more clarity around what the Fed is going to do. So by no means do we think, you know, we're in store for a 30, 35% drawdown like we saw amid the pandemic. We're just a little concerned given the uncertainty that markets just don't know what they're going to do. So from a short-term perspective, I think we have the tools to become a little bit more defensive. From a longer-term perspective, as you rightly mentioned, it is more conservative. But if, you know, some of these factors that we're looking at, like the inverted yield curve rears its ugly head or some of these other items that we're watching, then at that point, it might be worth considering, you know, reviewing the asset allocation and making sure things are in line with the committee's risk tolerance. So for right now, I think we're okay, but it's something that we could certainly revisit later this year as conditions change and unfold and throw it on the agenda and have that conversation.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Does anybody else have any questions for Pat? Okay, hearing none. Thank you, Pat. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, with that wraps up our meeting. So can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I have a motion and a second.
Second.
Okay, a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye.